Okay, so I've got my little pictures there. Two classic theorems from calculus. Extreme value theorem. Continuous function on a closed interval takes a maximum value and a minimum value. Last time I went through a proof that on a compact set, hence in particular on a closed bounded interval from A to B, you have the boundedness property as a consequence of uniform continuity. I proved it differently than the book there. And so, if A is a closed interval, closed bounded interval. I think our book doesn't use the word closed ray like I do. It calls it a closed unbounded interval. But anyways, if you have a bounded closed interval, right, or A is any compact set, not just a closed interval, but anything with a nice compactness property. So for the real line, that's the same as closed plus bounded. F is continuous on A, then F is, what was that nice thing, uniformly continuous on A. And then what I actually proved in the last part was, if you look carefully at the proof, what it actually shows is that if A is a closed interval AB, but actually this works for any set, right? I think I did it for any compact set, but the argument actually works for any bounded set. So kind of, this is a special case. And F is uniformly continuous on A, then I use this set of finite sample points to approximate the function. And uniform continuity got me the result that the range F of A is bounded. Slightly different approach than the book takes. The book actually gives a direct proof that on a compact set, your range has to be bounded, and indeed, has to include then also a minimum and maximum. Right. So a different approach, right? It takes a very topological version of the statement and proves that. Now, compact implies closed plus bounded. And bounded, in this case, implies you have a sup and inf, at least if you're non-empty. So if you tack on compact plus non-empty, so quintessential example of that is a closed bounded interval, right? That's compact and non-empty. Then you're closed and you're bounded and you're non-empty, which means you are closed plus you have a supremum and an infimum. And the fact that you're closed means that you have, okay, whatever your set A is doing in there, if the set is called A, whatever, you have a set, and then there's its infimum and supremum. Right? Now, the supremum, as I think of it, touches the set, or more precisely, for every epsilon, take the supremum minus epsilon, there's stuff in your set. So every neighborhood of the supremum hits the set. So that means the supremum, either it's already in the set as an isolated point, or it's a limit point, and then by the fact that we're closed, then again, it's already in the set. So if your set has a supremum and infimum, and it's closed, then it actually has a minimum and a maximum. Because it's closed. Right? Anything like the supremum and infimum that touch the set are actually in the set. Hence you get that nice extreme value theorem there. That feed in a compact non-empty set to a continuous function, and the output is again a compact non-empty set. And in particular, it has a minimum and a maximum, like in the classic, you know, pictures. You've probably seen something like this when you study calculus. Now, the book's first approach to 4.5 is analogous to this. It uses a topological thing. Okay. If A is connected, and you have to know what connected means, but if A is connected and F is continuous on A, then the image F of A, or the range, is that would be another word for it, if say A is the domain, the outputs form a connected set too. But what does connected mean? Connected, this would be a chapter 3 thing, right? I didn't really cover it before. So it's easier to define connectedness by what it's not if you're doing it topologically. So you say A is not a union, so say U union V, of two disjoint, non-empty, open sets. Which is kind of weird. But it makes sense if you think of this as the kind of the quintessential example of a disconnected. Well, even that's not quite right. In my topology class, I'd have to say yeah, this would work if I talked about the subspace topology, but. I think that's right. The book uses the limit points approach. So if A is a union of two sets U and V, U and V are non-empty, then U has a limit point. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to just skip over it because I don't want to use it for this class. It's complicated. There's something about if you have a disjoint union of A as two sets, one set has got limit points of the other, or, yeah, that's it. But I don't want to go into it. The nice thing about the real line is that connectedness is the same as convex. So here's how it works. If you have a point in A, and then you have another point in A, and then you have a point in between them, then the in-between point is also in there. So there's no holes in the set. Would be one way to think about it. You didn't cut anything out. X and Y are in there, then Z has to be in there too. So everything in between them, which matches the intermediate value theorem idea. So now I'm going to emphasize the second approach to this. Since I don't want to get into the limit point stuff. Okay. If we just directly do the intermediate value theorem statement. Okay. So, if we have a continuous function, and you have an intermediate potential value, right? So a number between the input-out points, then there exists a C strictly in between those endpoints. In my picture, there's actually three such C's, so it's not a uniqueness theorem, but it's an existence theorem. There's at least one C such that you exactly hit that potential intermediate output, right? The quintessential case is that if your function is negative at the left endpoint and positive at the right endpoint, it's zero somewhere in between, assuming continuity. In fact, you should really think of this as a test of, did we get the right definition of continuity? Right? If our definition of continuity did not imply this intermediate property, if we could somehow hop over zero, go just hop over from negative and go to positive without passing through the intermediate value zero, that doesn't sound like any intuitive notion of continuity where you can just hop over stuff, right? You know,
like the graphical intuition of continuity is that you can draw the graph without taking your pen off the board. Right? So any attempt to formalize the definition of continuity had better give us the intermediate value property, or it's probably not the right definition of continuity. Or I guess it's not a useful definition of continuity, right? You can make up a definition, but it might be useless, because it might not correspond to anything anybody cares about. So we do care about stuff like functions not being able to hop from negative to positive without going through the value zero somewhere in between. So our definition, at the very least, implies that. It's not actually equivalent to that. There's a tricky example, but it's become standard now. So this statement here is the intermediate value theorem, right? And you can also talk about just the conclusion of the theorem. So you have the intermediate value property. It's an if and only if. So this is a definition, okay? So for all A less than B, full from A, and all L strictly between F of A and F of B, so that means either F of A is less than L less than F of B, or F of B is less than L is less than A. So as long as it's strictly between, then again we claim that you can hit that intermediate potential output exactly. And so this C had better be in the domain of F, right? So some C and A are the domain of F, such that F of C hits it exactly. So this is just me rewriting the conclusion of the intermediate value theorem applied to a, you know, not another function F. So the IVT says that continuity implies the intermediate value property, or at least continuity on a closed bounded interval. Slightly more generally, you could say continuity on a connected set. Exactly. Now, on the real line, all the connected sets are intervals. They may be open or closed or half open. They may be bounded or unbounded, but all the connected sets are actually closed or actually intervals, because they have this convexity property that for anything in the set, everything else is in this. Everything in between is also in the set. There's no holes. So Now, what is an example that shows the converse fails? The book gives one example. It's a classic. An example of a function with this nice intermediate value property, yet it manages to be discontinuous. Anybody read 4.5 yet? What was the example? The folks that are in the chapter 4 group, one of their exercises is that if you have a monotone function, so either increasing or decreasing, then the only type of discontinuity of a monotone function is a jump discontinuity. So for a monotone function, you're going along, you're increasing, and then, oh, jump up. That would not have the intermediate value property, right? You would skip over a bunch of levels. So that wouldn't be an example of this. If you want to be discontinuous and have the intermediate value property, it can't be monotone because of this kind of a situation, right? L gets skipped, right? Maybe you have a discontinuity like this. It could be even slightly weird, or maybe the jump, the actual function itself is here, and the left limit is here, and the right limit is there, right? Yeah. So monotone discontinuities always skip some output. Same, flip the picture upside down, you have a monotone decreasing function. So we have to oscillate, and the oscillations have to get so bad that we get a discontinuity, even though we never jump over a value, so to speak. So how does the book make the oscillations get so bad? What's the example at the end of section 4.5 for the exercise?
Sine of 1 over x.
Sine of 1 over x.
X is not equal to 0.
So if x is not 0, you do the sine of 1 over x function, which is this horrible thing, right? Or this wonderful thing, depending on your point of view. If you like counterexamples, or if you don't. And we need to do something where sine of 1 over 0 is undefined. So the trick here is just pick a number. It really doesn't matter so much. Anything between negative 1 and 1 will work. It doesn't even have to be strictly between. But if you picked, 5, it wouldn't work, because then you could ask for the intermediate output of 4 and you wouldn't find it, because all the outputs of the sine wave are between negative 1 and 1. So as long as you pick something between negative 1 and 1 here. You have this picture here. The when x is large, 1 over x tends to 0, and the sine of 0 is 0. So you're going to have some kind of thing that kind of tends towards 0. And the sine wave oscillates between 1 and negative 1. But as we get close to 0, these oscillations are really going to pick up in frequency. We have this horrible thing. Okay. And the same thing over here. I think this is probably supposed to... Remember, yeah, the 1 over x function is actually decreasing, so a more accurate sketch, I guess, would have it like that. So, then over here, yeah, something like this. When x is large, this kind of asymptotically heads towards 0. But when x is small, then your 1 over x gets large and is changing rapidly as you bring x closer to 0, hence the sine wave starts oscillating very rapidly. Right? So you get this crazy amount of oscillation between 1 and negative 1. And you pick something in between negative 1 and 1 to just define the function in the middle. But now, you don't have continuity because the limit as you approach 0 in the inputs does not exist, right? Because you've got this horrible oscillation. You pick any sequence. Basically, you can have a sequence that converges to whatever you want. You could have a sequence of inputs that approaches 0, and the outputs could converge to a half, a third, you name it, just by choosing just the right angles, taking the reciprocals. This is, a discontinuity. But it still has the intermediate value property. You can pick any two points on the graph. So, for example, maybe I pick this one. Then I pick another point on the graph. It could be the point at the origin. Could be on the other side of the origin. Maybe I pick it to be over here. And what happens then if you ask for any intermediate level? Well, there's really not a problem because the sine waves just go up and... It goes up and down infinitely often in between those two points. So if I pick L to be, say, there, there's really not a problem. It's going to hit it right here, then it's going to come around and hit it again and again and again. So if this was my A, that was B, right? And you could pick just about any C you wanted in between there. There's infinite many to choose from. Right? Because it just oscillates up and down all the way from negative 1 to 1, over and over and over again. Okay, so you can cook up a distinction between our intermediate value property and continuity. But people still agree that, according to our intuitions, something like this, where when the inputs are close to 0, the outputs are all over the map between negative 1 and 1, this is not considered continuous. So people generally agree that this still is a good fit for our intuition. So we're going to keep our definition of continuity. Just bear in mind that if you look for strange functions, you can actually find subtle distinctions between things like intermediate value property and continuity. Whereas if you're just graphing the familiar polynomial functions, you'll never notice a distinction. All the polynomial functions are continuous, and they all have the intermediate value property. So that's something that comes up a lot in advanced math. You have two different concepts that in all the easy common examples or all the natural examples, they seem to be the same concept. But as a matter of precise definitions of how you stated them, mathematically they're not the same concept really, because if you look hard enough, you can find some weird example that actually has one of the concepts apply to it, but not the other. So a lot of advanced mathematics is like that. Either prove that two concepts are the same, as in anything that's an example of the one is an example of the other, and vice versa, or find a difference between the concepts. Actually cook up some weird thing that has one property but not the other. There's a classic thing in number theory, right? There's something called a perfect number, a number that is the sum of its proper divisors. Like 6 is 1 plus 2 plus 3. And then there's another easy concept, the concept of an even number. Now, you could ask, are the perfect numbers a subset of the even numbers? Is every perfect number an even number? Is one concept stronger than the other? Or is there a counterexample? Is there an odd perfect number? And I remember getting to teach a history of math once, and I was surprised when I read that the ancient Greeks asked this question, and we still don't know the answer to this day. Even simple concepts sometimes, we don't know if we can separate them with a weird example. If there is an odd perfect number, it has to be really big. But besides that, we can't say much more yet. Okay. Questions or comments about this? Okay. Let's go back to something from day 7. Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem. I walked through the ideas of that proof, even if I didn't write down a rigorous version. So they're talking about subsequences, and then what is the thing I said? Stuff piles up. You have a bounded sequence, so it's stuck between here and here. And then what was the strategy for proving that you had a convergent subsequence?
It converges to the same. Subsequence just converges faster?
Well, if you have a convergent sequence, the subsequences all converge faster to the same limit, right?
Yes.
But what if I have an arbitrary bounded sequence? It might not converge because it might oscillate in a crazy way that never settles down, right? It could just oscillate between the endpoints forever or something like that. So what we showed, Weierstrass showed first, right? If you have a bounded sequence, then even if it's oscillating all over the place, there's a subsequence that converges. Right? A subsequence that eventually gets as close as you want to a single number. Right? how do you actually get that subsequence out of your possibly wildly oscillating sequence, right? Or how do you convince somebody that the subsequence must be there, even if you're not sure exactly how to find it? And what's the argument? Nested interval property gets used, yes. But how do we get those nested intervals in the first place? The magic word starts with a B. Bisection. You cut the interval in half. The sequence is stuck in this interval forever. In particular, it visits this interval infinitely often. Okay? Now, if I cut the interval into two parts, and I let both parts share the middle point, so two closed subintervals, it has to visit one of those infinitely often, or what was the other word? Frequently, right? If you have a sequence that's frequently in an interval, then it's frequently in the left half, or it's frequently in the right half, or both. So we pick one of those halves, say it was this half, and we pick a half that it's frequently in. And then you look at this one, and then you cut it in half. And you say, okay, if I'm frequently in here, then I'm frequently in either that half of that, a half, so either frequently in this quarter of the original interval or frequently in that quarter. Let's say I picked this one because I know it's frequently in there. Well, then again, I can cut in half, and I must be frequently in one of these halves of that half of half. So now I'm down to an eighth of the original interval, and I know I'm frequently in one of those two eighths. Maybe it's this one. And then again, you can cut in half again. And now you're down to a sixteenth. Right? So you're getting narrow and narrow intervals, and each phase you pick an interval in which the sequence visits that interval infinitely often. And you just do that forever, and then with the nested intervals property you narrow down to a point, and since you have all those narrow intervals by that point where the sequence visits frequently, then you've got enough visits for you to pick out a subsequence that actually converges to that one point, just as the endpoints of our nested intervals are converging to one point, right? Our left endpoints, our right endpoints are coming to that one point. And we'll pick out a subsequence that is squeezed between the endpoints. That's where we're all good. The book's proof in its second approach to the intermediate value theorem uses the same strategy. It gives a bisection proof of the intermediate value theorem. Prove the Bolzano-Weierstrass theorem, the strategy is given a closed bounded interval with a sequence of points always in there, repeatedly cut I in half, and you have to have a strategy for choosing which half that you take. Always choosing a half visited infinitely often, right? Which is also called frequently in our book. Visited frequently by the sequence. Right? So. And then in 4.5, given our function now,
continuous. And now we have L. Let's call that interval I again. Okay. And L strictly between the endpoint outputs. We're going to repeatedly cut I in half. And we need a strategy for this. I should probably put proof strategies, right? Since these are neither of these is the complete proof. It's just the key idea of the proof. Which half do we choose? Always choosing the half, I guess, let's call the half J. So always choose the half J where you keep L strictly between the endpoint outputs. If possible. Now, actually, if you cross out strictly and just say between, then you can actually proceed here. So if you allow a less than or equal to. So here's the idea. I'll try and cash it out in detail now. I'll prove the IVT. So we start A and B, and we'll probably want to be keeping track of the endpoints. Let's call them A1, B1. Now, given that we've cut it up and cut it in half n times, let's describe the strategy for cutting it in half one more time. So suppose you cut it up such that you have f of a n less than or equal to l, less than or equal to f of b n, or if it's the other way around, you have f of b n less than or equal to L, less than or equal to A.
Yeah,
being
the bisecting function, right?
The function here. We're assuming f is continuous on I n. Right? So then you cut in half. Now there's kind of two pictures, or I don't know if you want to say four pictures. So maybe I can draw the four pictures and the different cases. Right? Let me leave the graph of f off, right? Because I want to emphasize just the points. Okay. Thank you. So you could be in this situation. Okay. Or what's one of the other situations we could be in? Maybe your L is like this. And there are other cases. Maybe L is actually exactly one of the three F values, right? So we're thinking about these different cases. And you could also have the ordering switched, right? Instead of F of BN at the top and F of AN at the bottom, you could switch them around, right? You could have F of BN at the bottom and F of AN at the top. If you want to label the inputs, then you have AN, CN right in the middle. And then there's BN. So you're cutting it in half. And the point is, one of those halves has to, when you consider the outputs at the endpoints, right, has to contain L. Right? So you want to, as I said in the strategy, always choose the half J that puts the target level L between the endpoint outputs. So that's how you get the next half. You can either have it be this half, like in this situation, you have to choose the bottom half. So I guess you have to get the output levels to be the bottom half, and that corresponds, actually, that's the output levels. Really, in this situation, the input would be the left half, right? So the intervals are input intervals, so I guess in this case, the left half, its endpoints have L between them. In this situation over here, to get L between the endpoint outputs, would need this, right? Now that's not necessarily going to convince you, right? Because there's other pictures, right? That's not all the cases. If you were thinking of a monotone function, those would be all the cases, right? Well, except for the whole flipping upside down part of it. If you have f of an below f of bn, you might naively think, oh yeah, f of c has to be in the middle. There's actually more cases. So you could have, let's see, the three levels. So again, let's say, here's f of an. And then maybe here's f of bn, and then here's the target level L. Now maybe actually f of cn jumps way up here. Maybe if you cut, you know, cut the interval in half, you actually get an output way up there. Can I still cut this thing in half so that one half will have its endpoint outputs have L between them? Which half should I take here? Left half or right half? Which half will have L's, will have the level L between, right? Let's see. The left half, right? So it still works. You can still do it. And the other possibility that you might consider is I could have had the L up here as well, but in any case, here's another picture. You could have. Let's say that this time the midpoint output actually drops down really low. So maybe we have this. This could happen. Okay. And maybe again L is kind of below the second dashed line, but above the third one. Right? So like that. Okay. So the function could drop way down when you take the midpoint as an input. But again, you can still cut it in half and get L between your endpoint outputs. Which half do I take here? Do I want the left half or the right half? Right half, yeah. Because then... Now this will be the end point of this half, and that'll be the other end point, and their output levels have L between them. So the input intervals are getting smaller and smaller, right? We're cutting them in half each time. But the output intervals may get bigger, at least some of the time. With continuity, they're eventually going to have to get small. But at least early on, they could get really big, right? Because the function could go way up, right, and way down in between your endpoints. So this proof has to work even for really oscillatory functions. I mean, not so oscillatory that they're discontinuous, perhaps. And then you could have a problem. The proof doesn't work anymore. But if they're continuous, we do want to allow for oscillation. There are only finitely many cases. Basically, it's going to boil down to you have to analyze all the possibilities, right? There's kind of three cases for where the midpoint thing can be, right? The midpoint's output is below, above, or between, right, the endpoint outputs.
So
I think you get 2 × 2 × 3, 12 cases in all, okay? Okay. So there's a bit of an art form. People try to come up with the proof that if they write a clever argument that tries to handle as many cases at once, you know, they start using words like between to kind of cover two cases at once, right? You know, which of these is, you know, is f of a n the low level or is f of b n the low level, right? Because, you know, you can't have both of those, right? I think in all my pictures here I drew f of a n as below f of b n, but you could turn all those pictures upside down to get the other cases. If you're writing the proof and you're really clever, you can probably come up with a short argument that handles a lot of the 12 cases, and maybe you can boil it down to something where you have an argument so general it breaks into just two cases or something. But the point is, in all 12 cases, you really can... either take the left half or the right half. And then you still have L at least weakly between the new endpoint outputs, right? So the new interval will be a sub n plus 1 plus b sub n plus 1. So in every case, you can cut it in half such that you're reproducing essentially the same situation. You have in your new smaller interval endpoint outputs and an intermediate level target output. So that's the bisection strategy once more, right? The trick is coming up with some criterion such that some property so that if you have an interval of this property and you cut in half, then either the left half or the right half or both halves will still have that property. So some property that reproduces itself on smaller scales like that. So once you figure out that property, Then the proof looks essentially the same, right? They all look the same. They all look roughly the same after that. Then you just use the nested intervals property. Right? So then you have, right? You know. Then the sequence of ans and the sequence of bns, they both converge, right? To C, right? Where C is actually the unique point in all of your intervals, right? These intervals are getting cut in half, right? So they're getting narrower and narrower. Their width is going to zero. So there's only room for one point in there. Right? So that's where you're using a completeness, if you will, right? Nested interval property. Or equivalently, the monotone convergence theorem gets you this part. Mm-hmm. You need the fact that the widths go to zero to know that you're actually getting one point, right? Okay. Okay. Okay, so yeah, I've got my intervals. I cut in half. Maybe it's like this. Something like that. So the endpoints are converging to the number C, and we haven't used continuity yet. Okay, that's got to come in somewhere, right? Okay, so last step. You're not going to like it if I try and squeeze it in at the bottom, so I won't try.
Okay.
Almost there, right? We just need to show that we actually hit the output level when we reach our limiting value C from all our bisections, right? We have this limit input C, and continuity should give us what we want, okay? So given a positive epsilon, we will prove that f of c is epsilon, is at most epsilon away from L, and that's enough. That's enough to prove the whole thing. Right? Because if this works for any epsilon, then they can't be different numbers, right? If they were different numbers, they'd be epsilon apart for some positive epsilon. So here you go. So f of a n and f of b n, f of b n are eventually f of c minus epsilon to f of c plus epsilon. Maybe I want to put it over here. We're going to show the L is this interval. I think that's the easier way to do it. So L is in the interval from f of c minus epsilon to f of c plus epsilon. So again, they're most epsilon apart. If that works for any epsilon, they've got to be the same number. Okay? And in fact, actually we can even make this strip inequality here. Yeah. Now, L is between every f of a and f of b n, right? Okay. So you have f of a n and f of b n in this little interval. And finally, wherever they are in there, you know that L is somewhere in between, right? maybe there's f of bn. Maybe here is f of an. So you're thinking wherever L is, right? It's got to be in between, right? But this argument works for any epsilon, so you actually have to have L there right at f of c. So that's the end of it. If I remember correctly, the homework is to do number 6. A nice little exercise using the ID. Thank you.